I received a text message this week from a friend in another state to ask me my opinion on something, because I've got lots of opinions. And he asked me, what do you think about this pastor in the news? It's up in North Carolina, so it's no one you know, but pastor in the news. So what do you think? The pastor built a $1.7 million house, 16,000 square feet. What do you think about that? I said, well, there's pastors with bigger houses. I don't know the whole story. Maybe he gave away 90% of his money to orphans and missionaries, and the 10% he had left, he was able to build that. And he likes hospitality, and he houses foreign college students while they're in the States. I don't know. He said, yeah, but what about the blue-collar guy who scrapes up his tithe every week and finds out that his pastor can build a tax-free $1.5 million house? I said, yeah, there's that side. If you have to spend a lot of time explaining to your church why there are helicopters flying over the house you build, maybe you could back off by 100 square feet, right? But my purpose this morning is to neither condemn or commend the guy. He stands or falls before his master just like I do. But my purpose is that as I was reading the stories, there was this one word that kept popping up. Extravagant.
That's accurate.
It's accurate. There's no emphasis marks on that to tell you which syllable to. Extravagant was the word used, and here's your definition: lacking restraint in spending money or using resources, exceeding what is reasonable or appropriate, absurd. Synonyms: lavish, wasteful, and squandering. So you read the stories, and those were the words that people use. But here, this morning, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to encourage this. We're going to pick up our Bibles, open them to a story about extravagance, and I'm going to encourage you to be wasteful. I'm going to encourage you to be wasteful, not in the sense of absurdity or squandering, maybe, but in the sense of doing what might be considered excessive or unreasonable. I wonder if you fight this in your own heart. I wonder if there's anything in your life with Jesus. You're walking close to him. And in that walk, others might look upon you and look at your life and say, well, that seems excessive. That seems a little unreasonable. Anything that sets you apart as being wasteful. In other words, if you have friends, classmates, co-workers who looked at your bank account or looked at a detailed way of how you spend your time, if they would look at you and say, you know, you're taking this Jesus thing to an unreasonable level, and then would they give you good reasons for why you're being inappropriate with this following Jesus thing? So this morning in our text, we come across just this extravagant worship. Jesus encounters someone whose worship and affection is not hindered or deterred in the least by thoughts of what is wasteful or lavish or inappropriate. But in the same scene, there's a man rebuking her who has good reasons for her to stop it, even though his good reasons seem to be, are apparently his disguise for idolatry. Absolutely what they are. And such it will be for us. We see the challenge in the challenger, and we see the challenge in the wasteful person, and we want to go towards the wasteful person, the excessive person, the extravagant person. We're back in the Gospel of John, if you want to turn there. Ask ourselves, what does this look like? What is this lavish worship look like? We're in John chapter 12, starting at verse 1 today. It says, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. And if you know John and you've been here, that happened just in the previous chapter, John chapter 11. Lazarus raised from the dead. I guess if you're Lazarus, you'll always be that guy who got raised from the dead, right? Jesus can no longer walk openly in Jerusalem. Jesus, there are wanted posters in Jerusalem. It says at the end of chapter 11 that all of the religious authorities had given orders that if anyone knew where Jesus was, they were to let them know and they were going to arrest him. So everybody in Jerusalem coming in for the Passover is wondering, will Jesus be here? Will Jesus make an appearance? Are we going to see Jesus? Is he going to come and teach? Is he going to come and heal? Because these people want to arrest him. So they're just picturing a conflict happening, right? Even though more and more people are coming to believe in Jesus. And so by going to Bethany, he's just a short 2 miles from Jerusalem. He will not be able to hide from the authorities. They will be able to find him there. And it's in Bethany where Lazarus was raised. So everyone knows, and lots of people are believing there in Bethany. And it says in verse 2, so they gave a dinner for him there. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. So kind of picture the scene. Jesus is the guest of honor. The dinner's for him. If Jesus raised you from the dead, the least you can do is invite him over for dinner, right? So you're gonna imagine what this is like. They're reclining at the table, they're down on the floor, they're laying on their side, on their side. The floor's in front of them, the table's in front of them, and there at the table sits Exhibit A for the power and grace of Jesus, Lazarus. And I don't know, what's it like when you have a meal with Lazarus and Jesus? Hey, Lazarus, tell us that story one more time. What was it like to be dead? Or maybe, Jesus, I got to tell you one more time what it was like when I heard your voice calling my name and I came back to life. And so you picture that. If you're familiar with Martha, you see what it says there. She's kind of moving back and forth to the kitchen, bringing the food, making sure everyone's taken care of. Sorry, I'm going to try to get rid of this wobble. Ah, that worked. Making sure everyone's taken care of. That's her gift. That's how she's made. That's how she honors Jesus, is with her putting a dinner together in his honor. But since the dinner is all about Jesus, verse 3 begins with a therefore, and this is where the conflict happens. Mary, therefore, took a pound, or maybe a litra, a Roman pound, equal to about 11 and a half ounces, or 327 grams, for those of you who dig the metric thing, took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard, and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. So just imagine like one of those really big half-liter sized cans of Coke, if you will. Only it's filled with this thick ointment kind of perfume. And as we'll see in the next verse, it's worth a year's wages to a day laborer. So if you were to just say you're a minimum wage worker, you're working, imagine this as a $30,000 jar of perfume, $25,000 jar of perfume, whatever you want, number you want to put it on there. This is a lifetime supply, right? And so you're going, wait a minute, where do you get the money for this? Maybe this is a family heirloom and it was carefully portioned out. Maybe everyone pooled their savings together. We don't know. But if there's anything we do know is that this is extravagant, to say the very least. But try to put yourself in Mary's shoes for just a moment. Mary had watched her brother die. Okay? Mary and Martha had grieved Lazarus' death for 4 days. Everyone had come out to their home and grieved with them. Now, there were questions about why didn't Jesus come? Jesus could have kept this from happening, right? This was Jesus' close friend. But the one who is the resurrection and the life is there at the table too, right? You basically got your brother back. So there's affection, right? There's wonder. There's awe. So her hair is let down, which would have been a little bit scandalous at a meal like this. And she's using her hair as a rag to wipe Jesus' feet as she puts this expensive ointment on Jesus' feet. And the smell of it fills every nook and cranny of the house. It's just this moment of extravagant wastefulness. This is totally unreasonable, right? Squandering almost. Which is what Judas says, at least. The first three words of the next verse bring us back down to earth. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was the thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put in it. So Judas is irritated, and I just imagine in this moment, right, the air leaves the room. Everybody's like, "We're about to have a fight." Yeah. Now, some translations seem to say that Judas already knew he was going to betray Jesus. Matthew and Mark seem to even say that after this scene, he goes out and cuts the deal. We know the seeds are there because he's wanted. Jesus is. But what we don't know is anybody else in the room thinking what Judas says, right? I mean, do any of the disciples go, "Fair question"? What we do know is that Judas said what he said for all the wrong reasons. And of all the people in the room, only Jesus knew Judas' heart. Because this sounds like such a godly thing to say. Jesus cares about the poor, right? And Judas had everyone fooled. Do you remember? Later on, we're going to see at the Last Supper, Jesus says, "One of you is going to betray me," and Judas gets up and leaves the table. And what do the other 11 say? "Oh, he's going to take care of the poor." That's Judas. Such a good-hearted man, right? He had disguised himself so well that no one even suspected that he was the betrayer or would have thought that he was a thief. So Judas' outrage over the situation is just a disguise for his sin, and he's paving the way for his own death. I mean, he's complaining about, if you will, $25,000 worth of perfume. He's going to sell Jesus for $1,000. So Judas feels nothing that Mary feels. Judas does not value what Mary values. Judas' heart does not correspond to the worth of Jesus. This isn't a compassionate statement, it's a greedy one. Judas only knew one kind of value. What could we have got for that? And behind that is Judas was for Judas. Jesus chose Judas knowing he would be a betrayer. Jesus chose Judas to take care of the money bag and be the treasurer knowing he would be a thief. And to him, Mary was being absurd and wasteful and squandering of this perfume. Just think so. You're sitting with a guy who was dead and was called back to life. You're sitting with the man who called him back to life, and you're thinking about what you could have got for this perfume. I could have had more money. Judas complains about a year's worth of wages while eternal treasure is sitting right there, receiving the thankful, joyful, amazed worship of Mary. Can you see how far apart the hearts are here? In verse 7, Jesus said, "Leave her alone." Ouch. Can you feel that? That's what you say to a bully. He's picking on somebody. "Leave her alone, so she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but do you not always have me?" First glance, you're thinking, well, Jesus, that's not very compassionate. It's kind of harsh. You'll always have poor people. You won't always have me. Only Jesus can get away with saying this. Kids, don't try that at home. Mom, Dad, I'll only be in your home for so many years. There'll always be poor people, right? Yeah. No. She has kept this for the day of my burial. It's a little difficult little phrase there because it seems as if she poured it all out. It's got to be more going on here than just the perfume. It's the entire act itself. It's the moment. Because he's going to die. He just says it for my burial, your burial. Little hint there, something's going to happen, right? He's already given the hint. We're going up to Jerusalem, we read in the other Gospels. We're going up to Jerusalem. I'm going to be betrayed and handed over, and I'm going to die. In other words, when I'm buried, she's going to need this. She's going to need me as her treasure when I go through what I go through. This moment of worship, when I'm beaten and arrested and beaten and bruised and bloody, when I'm placed in a tomb, she's going to need this. She's going to need to remember I'm the one she worshipped. And it's one of those moments like when Caiaphas prophesied and he didn't know what he was prophesying. Seems that she's maybe doing more than she knows that she's doing. So there's an old saying, some people know the price of everything and the value of nothing. Judas. So basically, Jesus is saying, Judas, you have the rest of your life to take care of the poor. She has this moment. Don't infect her with your attitude. Leave her alone. Now, think about what Jesus knows about Judas that no one else knows. And think about what he just said. It's my burial. You won't always have me. He's looking at Judas when he says that. It's at your hands, Judas. In other words, there are times, Judas, that are specifically devoted to nothing but the sacrifice of praise and adoration. And this is one of them, Judas, the preciousness of the presence of Jesus. And Jesus' delight at being treasured. We just see this principle that we absolutely have to get, that the delight in the heart of God, when the worth and value of Jesus matches the adoration and devotion of your heart, right? When the intensity of our affections for Jesus match who he is, right? Corresponds with his glory. Jesus' delight at being delighted in, because he knows we've made it to the ultimate treasure. There's nothing beyond him. Judas can't even begin to see it, and Mary is just being extravagant in it. And nobody else gets it either, if you want to look at 9, 10, 11. When the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, Jesus is in Bethany, at Lazarus' house, they came, not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So it's a little circus happening here. So the chief priest made look at this, this is unreal. The chief priest made plans to put Lazarus to death as well, because on account of him, many of the Jews are going away and believing in Jesus. So now Jesus doesn't just need to die, Lazarus needs to die. Do you see what's happening here? You can come up with all sorts of reasons why Jesus died. But here we have God pulling back the curtain a little bit for us. Why do they want Jesus dead? Why do they want Lazarus dead? Envy? Fear? He's taking our followers away from us. One more little thing that I think, this has been coming home to me. We've been going to community Bible study and studying the book of Revelation. And it's amazing how much the book of Revelation doesn't tell you, but we say about it anyway, right? Sometimes the Bible doesn't bother explaining things to us. And it bugs us. And we wish it was explained. And that generally doesn't stop us. But But there's something here that bugs me. Maybe it bugs you too. But I think it's an incredible picture. Jesus gave the money bag to a thief. He's got Nathanael, the man in whom there is no deceit. Give him the money bag. Levi, good grief, he was a tax collector. Here's a guy who knows how to balance a budget. Give him the money bag. Why Judas? People are giving to a nonprofit ministry. They expect good stewardship of their funds, right? Jesus, maybe you need a board, right? But I think there's something happening here that just further shows us what Jesus is communicating in this story. For example, Jesus said, lay up your treasure in heaven. Jesus did this. But in this story, we have a tragic, heartbreaking example of what it means to lay up your treasure on earth. Judas. Jesus said, you can't serve two masters. You can't serve God and money, because what will end up happening is you'll be devoted to the one, you'll hate the other, you'll love the one, you'll hate the other, right? Judas, a shocking, heartbreaking example of loving money and trying to serve two masters. Horrible consequences. Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. 1 Timothy 6:9. So the picture that the Bible provides is that with every coin Judas stole and put in his own pocket, he was like a drug addict looking for his next hit, and he's using people, right? How will it benefit me? And his heart just gets harder and harder and harder. All the while, immeasurable worth is right there, immeasurable value, and Mary responds extravagantly. So, to put it in different words, as one of my favorite authors says about this passage, Mary and Judas were both hedonists. Both of them were concerned with treasure and pleasure. Neither was simply doing their duty. Right? Mary doesn't say, oh, it's my duty to pour out this perfume. No, she's lavish in her worship. She can't help herself. It's delight. Judas doesn't say, it's my duty to steal the money. No, he's greedy. He's all about him. For Mary, Jesus was the termination point in her joy. For Judas, silver made him happier than Jesus did, and Judas seals his faith. So, as we kind of close this out, it's obviously, I started with a story of a pastor in his house. This isn't a story about a pastor in his house. It's a story about everybody in this room, about worship, and about the kind of people we become when we value Jesus more than anything else, or value anything else more than Jesus. So let me just bring out two or three things. Just one I'm just going to throw out in your lap and let you take it home and turn it around a little bit. It's been said we live in the age of outrage. Social media is awesome for that. If you want to get outraged, just get on Facebook or Twitter, and you can just get mad about 53 things in 5 minutes. It's amazing. Right? The day of outrage, and Christians are just as outraged as everybody else, but I'm just going to let you ask yourself the question. Judas was outraged, and his outrage was a disguise for his idolatry. And I wonder if Christian outrage is just a disguise for our own idolatry and love of the things of this world, like power and money. That's yours. Take it home. I'm not going to go any further. Mary gave the most valuable thing she had, and I've spent the week wondering, how do you measure that? I don't know what the most valuable thing you have is, right? One indicator might be, what makes you most anxious if you have to give some of it away? Might be your time. Oh, I just don't have 15 more minutes. Jesus says, how about 15 minutes? No, right? So, or what are you afraid others will say when you give it up? Kind of the way you measure value in your life. It's just easy to moderate your worship out of fear. Rein that in a little bit, Dean. What will this person think? Or what will this cost? Right? Discontent, greed, envy, fear. Everything that says, hey, don't be wasteful. And think about the spirit of Judas in this world and what it says to you. You're all out there every day. The spirit of Judas in this world says, you know what? You get up early the other days of the week. Right? Come on. You deserve it to sleep in on Sundays. Why would you give vacation time to serve, to go there? You know, you could have retired by now if you hadn't given all that money away. Right? You pour out your time, you pour out your money, you pour out all of this, and Judas of this world is just saying, that seems a little wasteful. It's not reasonable. It's kind of absurd. And Jesus says, you found life. You found life. What the world calls waste, we call worship, because Jesus is worthy. And how much you treasure Jesus is measured by what you would give up to know him better and make him known. And the real waste is to get as much perfume as this world offers and then lose your soul in the process, right? This really also comes down to just, let me finish with this, just corporate worship, right? When we gather, just, there's a couple of values that we've talked about a lot here. Especially like when it comes to Sunday morning and corporate worship. One is that we can, we can value simplicity, right? Keeping it simple. The other thing is just present the truth in song and prayerfully present that, passionately present that, and let the Spirit cause a response. If you've ever noticed, Joey doesn't scold you in worship, right? I don't know how he does it. Like, if I'm leading in the happy song and people look like they've been sucking lemons, I'm on that. I'm like stopping the guitar. I'm like, what is wrong with you people? This is the happy song. There ain't a happy face in this room, right? He's much more patient. He's a good guy, right? He might encourage. Come on, let's sing, right? He doesn't do that much. It's there. It's on the screen. And he's look at that. That's truth that he's trying to get us to see. That doesn't move you, right? The work, the character of God in Christ, how deep the Father's love for us. Look what he does. He restores our soul, right? That should move your heart to worship. Even if you don't think you're a singer, it should move your heart to worship. So that's kind of one of the values. We don't scold, right? And just the other is just simplicity, right? There's room up here for, you know, another singer. You know, there's room for a couple of more people, but we've always valued just kind of a simple approach. Two things about corporate worship that we valued. You've heard me say this. Simplicity and non-comparison, right? Because you know what? You know what Mary could have used instead of perfume? A smoke machine and some lasers. Right? I remember going to a conference one time, this big, huge church. It was a really cool conference. But I was sitting beside a friend of mine, and he goes, you see that row of lights up there? I was like, yeah. And there were these really cool lights. They moved every which way, and you know, it was really cool. And I said, yeah. He said, each one of those lights cost $25,000. And I went, holy cow, one, two, three. I'm like, dude, that's more than you and I combined to make in a year. Then what happens? You get envious. You start comparing. Well, I don't have lights like that. dang, look at his smoke machine coming out. That's pretty sweet, right? Yeah. Non-comparison. See, because when you compare, you can always find someone you think is doing it worse and someone you think is doing it better, instead of just saying, we're just us, and we value just kind of keeping it simple. I remember way back in the very beginning we asked this question. We made this statement. We never want anyone to go when they leave here. Was that the spirit or was it the lighting? Right? Just, that's kind of a funny thing to say. We don't mean that, but we do mean that, right? Here's the deal, and we'll finish with this. We don't worship so that. You know what I mean by that? We don't worship so that. This is in your house. You know this, right? You don't do things, men. You don't do things for your wife so that. Am I right? Thank you. Yeah. You don't. Men, we're on the same page, right? Yeah. You don't do things for your wife so that. You just do things for your wife. And wives, you don't do things for your husband so that. You just do things for your husband, right? In other words, the kind things you do for each other are not preparation for something else. Right? That's the other thing about studying Revelation. It's like, this is the end, and they're just worshiping, and they're not going, what's next? What time is this service over? It's forever. Oh, right? Sheesh. Is there a game? Yeah. Right, it's... Worship isn't so you get to the good stuff. Worship is the good stuff. Everything in the universe terminates to Jesus, right? Just one more thing. C.S. Lewis wrote this little thing called Meditation in a Tool Shed, which sounds weird, but he walked into a tool shed. He shut the door, and it was dark in the tool shed. But he noticed that there was a beam of light coming through a crack in the door, and the only thing you could see in the tool shed was the beam of light. And it was an interesting thing. So he's studying the beam of light. Look at that beam of light. You can see dust going through it, and it shines from there to there, and there's a little place on the floor you can see because of it. But then he walked over, and he stood in the beam of light, and he looked up at the beam of light, and he could look outside, and he could see trees and clouds and the sun, leaves moving. He was like, that's life. You can stare at the beam, or you follow the beam back to its source, and because of the beam, you can see everything else, right? That's Jesus. You follow all of his good gifts. You follow everything good he gives. All the good stuff that comes through Jesus, you just keep following it back, and you get to Jesus, and that's the end, and you just worship, right? Because Jesus can't be quantified. Can't be measured. He's immeasurable. So then we just get absurd in what we would do for him. Just unreasonable what we do for him. You pray with me? Lord, I pray that our lives would be poured out like this. Lord, if we could see you, just even earlier, singing the word holy, and realizing that when Isaiah saw holy, he was undone. Woe is me. If we could see holy, if we could see beauty, if we could see goodness and grace, if we could see truth, if we could trace that all back to you and just see you, we would just be undone. And we'd be just like, whatever it takes, I'm pouring it all out for you. I don't care what the world says. I don't care what the spirit of Judas in this world says. You're worth it, Jesus. You're worth it. If we asked ourselves that question, is this worth it? Well, Jesus is worth it. Yes. And I don't know what that's going to look like when my brothers and sisters get up and go to work tomorrow or go to school in every detail. But I do know that you will make of us a people that the world kind of trips over because the gospel of Jesus Christ, the glory of Christ, is doing stuff to us. Direct our steps, Lord. Grace and truth with Jesus in worship. And Lord, I know, I'm reminded of Hudson Taylor, who just gave up every financial, every worldly possession he had to go to the inland of China to reach those people. And when he came to the end of his life, he said, I never made a sacrifice. Because what I got in return was Jesus. And in the light of Jesus, it wasn't a sacrifice. It was joy. So, Lord, I pray that we'd all have that testimony. We didn't make any sacrifices. We got Jesus. Can't quantify him. Do that in our hearts, Lord. Because this world and our flesh and the devil are going to fight against this tooth and nail. To strengthen us daily, glimpses of who you are. May the joy of the Lord be our strength. May the value of who you are correspond to the affection in our heart. In your name we pray, Jesus. Amen.
You've been listening to Sunday Morning at Creekside Church in Spring, Texas. We're glad you joined us. For more information, please check out our website at www.mycreeksidechurch.org.